Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And today I'm going to be talking a little bit about the global crisis of inflation that occurs from about 1916 onwards and peaks in the mid-1920s as a direct result of the First World War. Now, those of you who do GCSE history or A-level history and have done Nazi Germany will know that by 1923, Germany had experienced a hyperinflation crisis. And the conventional wisdom on this subject is that the Weimar government was to blame, and the printing of banknotes in order to fund general strikers in the Ruhr who had downed tools in protest against the French and Belgian occupations led to this spike in prices and, explosion in prices where certain items by December 1923 were costing up to a trillion Reichsmarks, and a collapse in the value of currency and a collapse in the value particularly of savings, thus wiping out the modest means of the middle classes and the Mittelstand, the lower middle classes. This is all correct, but the causes of hyperinflation go back really to the Kaiser's funding of the war, and even the fiscal policies of the Kaiser's government before the war. And the Kaiser's government was by no means the only offender. If you look at both the Austro-Hungarian Empire and the Russian Empire, both of them afflicted by inflation during the war, and inflation particularly during the period of the Russian Civil War is something that leads to an agrarian crisis. The peasants well know that paper money is becoming next to worthless, and it's one of the reasons that encourages hoarding. Lenin's interpretation of this is that this is bourgeois capitalist speculation, and that this constitutes the peasants as a class enemy, and it's one of the reasons for the policy of war communism, though obviously war communism is also motivated by Lenin's desire for a bloody class terror. It's his opportunity in order to bring about social revolution under the shadow of civil war. But inflation does have a kind of a key role to play here. Inflation and shortages are part of the reason why the Tsarist government collapses in February 1917 as well. So how do we account for this phenomena of inflation? Well, on one level, you have governments such as the Kaiser's in Germany, who believe that The war for national survival that Germany is engaged in is of such a magnitude that nothing can be done, nothing should be done to affect civilian morale. The notion of the Bergfried in Germany, the peace within the fortress, the social truce between parties of left and right, the SPD, the Christian Democrat Party, and the Nationalist and Conservative parties, and their respective supporters amongst the German population. This must not be affected in any way. The Kaiser before the war says, you know, I wish to be the Kaiser of all the Germans, and attempts to present himself as the people's Kaiser. And so the idea of introducing taxation during wartime, which is going to either be income tax and going to, even if it's progressive income tax, upset the middle classes, or it might take the guise of something of a tax on consumption, a sales tax, or in, as we would understand it in Britain, something akin to VAT, which would place the burden of taxation on the poor. Any kind of taxation, from the Kaiser's point of view, was going to create social division and unhinge this loose social truce that was so essential to keep the war effort going. And the idea of social cohesion, the idea of social harmony, was one that nearly every combatant power was very mindful of. The British particularly were aware that the war had kind of saved them by a whisker from some serious upheavals with syndicalist trade unions, and, you know, even more likely, the possibility of a civil war in Ireland, though that is kind of a different story. So maintaining social harmony was important, and how does one do this? Well, one way is to put off the bill for paying for the war to the indefinite future, and that can be done by borrowing. Or, in the case of the central powers who have less access to credit, by printing. All powers were able to borrow from their populations in the guise of war bonds, though for most of the combatants in the First World War, war bonds are something that really become a kind of a currency slightly later on, when the treasuries become progressively depleted and the cost of winning and the cost of mounting major battles such as the Battle of the Somme become realised. In the West, the British and the French, and then later the Italians, rely on the commercial banks in America for large injections of cash, and later on these injections of cash, as the United States becomes more and more likely to enter the war as an associate to the Allied powers, these injections of cash are underwritten by the Federal Reserve. So we have more money within a fixed economic system, again, which is a potentially inflationary factor. And it is, incidentally, this Atlantic system of finance and credit, you know, the most advanced hubs of finance and credit in the world really are London and New York. And New York outstrips London during the First World War. Having access to this finance is a key part of the British and the French's arsenal. France, Italy, and Russia also are their loans from the USA are guaranteed really by the City of London and by the Bank of England. So the British at this stage were underwriting most of Europe's finance and credit. As I mentioned, in the East there was a reluctance to tax, particularly in Germany, and a desire to avoid any confrontation or any excess acrimony, social acrimony, on the home front. And the thinking of the Kaiser and the Habsburg monarchy was that ultimately war debts would be repaid and economies would be balanced when the war was won by indemnities and reparations forced upon conquered nations such as the French or the Russians or whomsoever else. So the outcome of the war was going to pay for and finance its cost, the cost of conquest. And the Kaiser figured that the German army tended to be that which performed best on the battlefield, so why not bank on the possibility that the performance of the German army would ultimately result in Germany's books being balanced at the end of the war. It's quite a gamble, and it kind of explains when Germany doesn't lose the nature of the epic financial crisis that engulfs Germany between 1919 and really the mid 1930s. If we're to find a real culprit overall for this massive, and it's a global surge in inflation during and after the war, it's the enormous increase in government debt on all accounts. So all combatant powers, because of the unexpected size and scope and scale of the war, all government powers have enormous increases in debt. And with this enormous surge of demand in the economy, demand for really every kind of raw material, every kind of manufactured or finished product, the only thing that was ever going to keep prices stable was an equivalent increase in economic output. And basically, for non-economists out there, inflation tends to happen when there's too much money whizzing around a fixed system, a fixed economic system, where there is a fixed amount of production. Therefore, if you have a factory that builds, that makes steel girders, and everybody, for some reason, i.e. because it's useful for the war, is bidding with cash for these steel girders.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom,
like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The prices of them will go up unless you can create hundreds and hundreds more, or thousands or tens of thousands of more steel girders to satisfy the demand, thus bringing down the prices. The whole of the economy becomes like a huge bidding auction. And this is what happens by about 1916, particularly in the United States of America, which has the biggest and most productive war economy. Even though not a combatant power, it is churning out all sorts of equipment for the Allied powers. And yet it reaches a kind of a production ceiling. Whereby after which it cannot produce more goods without long-term capital investment, the building of new roads, railways, factories, ports, docks, coal mines, that kind of thing. The America that existed in the Second World War had gone through that process and had substantially more industrialization and development between 1916 and 1941, which joins the war. There is a brilliant point that Adam Tooze makes in The Deluge when he says that in 1917, when the Americans come to Europe, American soldiers are fighting with French rifles, whereas in the Second World War, after 1944, when the French land at Normandy with the British, you've got French soldiers fighting with American rifles. So America hasn't quite become the productive superpower it is during the Second World War, and again that means that there are these considerable inflationary pressures, and the inflationary pressures spill out of Europe and America across the world. You have prices in Africa for basic staples shooting up by a factor of five. You have the wages of workers in Rhodesia dropping by, the real wages of workers, shall we say, in Rhodesia dropping by 50%. In Egypt, the cost of living escalates dramatically because the British, who dominate Egypt, switch the value of the currency, which was once based on the prices of Egyptian cotton, to the values of basically the price of British war debt. So the Egyptian currency is linked to Britain's debts, and suddenly, as a result, Egypt's money supply explodes, and so does inflation. The same process happens in India. And in both Egypt and India, you're dealing with largely agrarian peasant societies where the peasants themselves are very loath to, as with Russian peasants, loath to rely on paper money, paper debt, and have a tendency to hoard, which inevitably has a knock-on effect when it comes to the food supply in rural areas and the possibility of drought. Eventually, in India, the Americans step in and begin to supply the Indian economy with silver again, and the Indian peasants tend to prefer to have silver coin, knowing that its value is far less likely to depreciate than paper money is. The combatant powers, in nearly every single instance, all find they have serious unrest on the home front, and the strikes that you can see happening in Britain during the First World War and in Germany have less to do with the objections of British workers to things like conscription or the war in question. You know, various Marxist historians have tended to appropriate the industrial unrest on the home front as some kind of statement in favour of peace. But if you look at the attitudes of British workers by the end of the First World War, they tended to look at the war as having been a worthwhile endeavour. They tended to look at the war as having been really necessary, and they tended to look at the war as having been really an act of German aggression and an opportunity to punish Germans. This is the December 1918 coupon election, really is largely fought around this theme. So the argument that there are these kind of radical anti-war workers out there en masse, I mean, there are obviously a few, is dubious. The thing that in Germany, in France, in Britain, and in other combatant countries that the workers are striking over is prices and wages. Workers who have managed to secure themselves jobs in important war industries are more able to extract higher pay claims. And Lloyd George, as Chancellor, was quite aware of this, and in 1915 was prescient enough to have the trade union leadership into Number 11 to sign what he was loosely called the Treasury Agreement, which was an understanding on industrial action during the war. And it was one which made sure that more essential workers did receive preferential pay in return for an end to strikes and lockouts and restrictive closed shop practices that kept non-skilled or non-unionised workers out of skilled jobs. Because obviously if you have skilled workers going off to the front, you need people to fill their roles. And the unions were agreed not to prevent this from happening. It also meant that the unions had more input in the war economy and in planning, and this has a knock-on impact in attitudes towards the unions in the post-war years and attitudes towards planning in general. This general loose agreement by Lloyd George was given, put onto statute in the Munitions of War Act 1915, so eventually striking became illegal anyway. But the government were wary of cracking down on it to a greater extent during the war. So this surge in inflation is just one of the aspects of the unbalanced global economy that emerges after 1918. The British wartime economy doesn't really manage to rebalance itself after the war. There's a brief economic boom from 1919 to 1920, where the government predicts that repressed demand for luxuries and household items that people haven't been able to buy during the war because of the German U-boat blockade, and then following the institution of rationing in 1918, they believe that this repressed demand will come to meet a new increase in the supply and availability of goods now that obviously there is a much decreased demand for military hardware, and that the economy will somehow balance itself and prices will come down and there will be a relatively stable economy. And there is for a year, and then there is a collapse. There is a bust that follows the brief boom, and it's a bust that's based around the kind of the long-term structural problems that have existed within the British economy and have been exacerbated by the war. Older, uncompetitive industries which have really suffered as a result of the war and have lost world share and world markets. For the rest of the world, you have a decade in the 1920s that is based on a really, really shaky foundations. There is too much money in the global economy. This means that there is a tendency towards inflation across the world. And the large amount of debt that's accrued means that there is an awful lot of speculative capital available. The brief boom in Britain that happens, as I've mentioned, between 1919 and 1920, sees the biggest influx in British history of capital into the stock market, as people sought to buy up some of the kind of staple British industries of steel, shipbuilding, cotton, and coal, only to find really that these are industries in terminal decline. And similarly, by the end of the 1920s, in both America and Britain, it's large influxes of speculative capital into the stock market that cause the kind of destabilization that leads to the Wall Street crash and is one of the contributory factors to the worldwide economic slump during the 1930s. Anyway, I hope you found this useful. This one goes out to my good friend Berlin Penzance, who has been kind enough in financial terms to send the Explaining History podcast something of a stipend and mentioned that he was kind of keen to listen to some economic history. So I hope this finds you well today. The Explaining History podcast marches on to its 40,000th subscriber. We are but a few hundred listeners off that glorious figure. So thanks everyone for supporting us so far. It's been an absolutely amazing year. And we're only halfway through. There are two new textbooks coming out for the EdXL and AQA syllabuses. So they should be ready to order pretty soon. I've got a new ebook in the post. My publishers are getting ready to put it out there on Victorian Britain, and I should be ready to publish the next in the Century series by Tyrell Eskelson on the American Century in the next few weeks. So keep your eyes peeled for all these exciting new developments, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.